Sorry, you're not on the mic.
We could start it now, huh? Let's go ahead and call this meeting to order for Campo on June 12th at 4:30, right on the nose. So can I get roll call, please, Kathy?
Chairperson Kimbrough.
Here.
Vice Chairperson Stedfield.
Here.
Member Bagwell.
Here.
Member Bonkowski.
Here.
Member Erb.
Here.
Member Keller.
Here.
Member Macquarie.
Here.
Ex officio Member Rosenberg.
Here.
Quorum is present.
Everybody's here tonight. Any items on the agenda that might need a change tonight?
Not tonight, Mr. Chair.
Great, thank you. Are there any disclosures for any items on the agenda from the board tonight? Seeing none, we'll move on. For a chance for public comment, if there's anybody in the room that'd like to come forward and make a comment on any item, hopefully not on the agenda, but we'll entertain that too. Lucia, did you want to use this to introduce? That's an opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So here tonight we have Christy Park. She is the new general manager for our JAC Transit system here in Carson City. So I wanted to introduce her. Christy, I don't know if you wanted to say anything, but she's been here a couple months, and so far it's just been night and day from previous operations. We are fully staffed for the first time in a couple of years. We have our... Say that again?
Oh, don't say it.
I know. I always do that. But we're just thrilled to have her. She's doing a really good job.
Thank you for having me. I'm enjoying the challenge, and I look forward to increasing the happiness of the riders and the drivers. Thank you.
That's a nice goal. All right, thank you. Any other public comments? Seeing none, we'll bring it back to minutes, approval minutes for the May 8th meeting. Do I have any changes or a motion?
I move to approve the minutes of the Carson Area Metropolitan Planning Organization for May 8th, 2019 as presented.
Second.
I have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Seeing none, call for the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are covered. We move to the public meeting items for 6A for information only. Presentation discussion on task 5.1, the asset planning and management of Campo's 2019-2020 Unified Planning Work Program.
Thank you, Chair. Dirk Warren for the record. So as part of Campo 2020 Unified Planning Work Program, funding was budgeted to hire a contractor to help survey pavement in Douglas County within the Campo portion. This is similar to the services that Campo did for Carson City in 2017. Approximately 40 lane miles of regional roads and approximately 94 lane miles of local roads were surveyed. I'm going to paraphrase here, but the contractor uses a very expensive van that has 3D laser technology and cameras to collect roadway distresses and to identify the severity of those distresses. Those distresses are then calculated into a pavement condition index, a lot of times referred to as PCI, which is a scale of 1 to 100, 100 being pavement in perfect condition. The map that was attached, I kind of noticed it as it was pointed out to me, that the scale does not really show what's good or what's bad. So on the attachment, 100 is a road in perfect condition. The survey is done to specific industry standards to ensure consistency over time and to help us accurately assess pavement conditions. Additionally, the contractor performed quality control measures while they were in the van and then also the data collection process. The data survey was imported into pavement management software that was then provided to Douglas County and to Campo. This is information that Douglas County will use to help make efficient decisions on the maintenance of their pavement. And then for Campo staff, this will allow us to help us report on MAP 21 requirements, which is the performance-based planning that we keep on hearing requirements on. So I would that does conclude my comments. I do want to take this time to also let Lyon County know that this type of service is available if they ever need it. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
Dirk, maybe you do or don't know, but I noticed this was for 134 lane miles in Douglas County. How many lane miles do they have? So like 5% of the roads, 10%? Put you on the spot. You can ignore me.
John Erb, for the
record. John Erb, for the record. As far as lane miles, with all the GIDs and the towns and that, we have around 778 lane miles in the county, but what's actually maintained by Douglas County is about 167 lane miles of road. I don't have that memorized for lane miles. You would double that. We don't have a lot of four lane roads, but so.
This got a good percentage of the Douglas County roads to be maintained, not your GIDs.
It got most of the North County, yeah. And we were very happy with Campo providing the service for us. It was a great benefit.
For reference, Carson City has about 283 center lane miles of roadways that we maintain. Most of it pavement, but some of that includes dirt and gravel.
So actually, John, I'm going to put you back on the spot. I was going to ask, do you use the same method on the rest of the roads? Or this is kind of a really big benefit, like you said, for have Campo come in at least do the evaluations for you. But does it match what the rest of the stuff you got?
This is the first time we had the automated service using a van. All of our PCI has been surveyed by manpower.
Wow.
Through the years. But it's been real hard to keep up with it because usually we use an intern or something like that to help us in the summertime. So we've just got the data. We want to really kind of compare how it compares with doing it out in the field by hand versus the automated service. But we did present it to the RTC board 2 weeks ago, and RTC is very interested in having the rest of the county done this way, just to save on personnel hours doing
staff time and training. Surgery.
Yeah.
Well, I thought that would be great. I thought that would be a motivation. Having Campo do this for you would motivate to move the system into that, which was the benefit of Campo paying for it originally, I guess.
You hope. We hope. The technology is improving, and it's definitely gotten better over the years.
All right, thank you. Any other comments? Anybody from the public like to come forward on this item? Informational only. So we're going to bring it back to the board then for no vote, and we'll go to 6B for possible action this time. Discussion and possible action regarding the submission of a grant application to the Federal Transit Administration for federal fiscal year 2019 grants for buses and bus facility programs, seeking a total of $650,000 with a local match of $195,000, 30%, to replace jump around Carson transit system fixed route vehicles.
Hi, Michael Reynolds, staff here. So I wanted to let you know this is FDA's announced, of course, an additional year of funding for this grant. This will be our third year applying for it. We were awarded this grant in 2017 with a similar model of the 30% local match. Last year, this is a very competitive grant. We were not awarded this last year. There were 339 applications. Only 107 of those were awarded. We are hoping to get this year. It does go in line with our transit asset management plan to be able to have this funding to replace buses, buy new buses, that kind of thing. So if you guys choose to approve this today, we are going to look at submitting the application on or before Friday, June 21st.
Any questions? Brad?
So this would allow us to purchase two additional buses above and beyond the two that we currently have on order and we're waiting for delivery?
That's correct. And just to announce it, we received those buses this week. They're going on route hopefully tomorrow. So those brand new ones, you'll see them out there this week.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing anybody from the public like to come forward to speak to this item? Seeing none, bring it back to the Board for a motion or comments?
Motion. I move to approve submission of the grant application as presented.
Second.
I have a motion and a second. Any more discussion? Seeing none, call for the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Unanimous. Thank you. Mike Z, your first action item, and you got a unanimous approval there. So now you just got to get the buses. Real pressure on you now. All right, 6C, another for information only. Presentation discussion on Task 3.2 Transit Planning Campus 2019-20 Unified Planning Work Program. Lucia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lucia Maloney, Transportation Manager. I'm going to tee this one up here for Mike. As you know, CAMPO approved a contract with LSC Transportation back in February using CAMPO's Unified Planning Work Program, Task 3.2 funding, as well as just over $25,000 in transit planning funds from NDOT for this effort. The contract's been executed and the plan's underway, so staff felt that we should be appropriate to bring an update back to you and the public. Just a reminder, development of the plan goes in steps. There's a technical memorandum number one, which provides existing conditions. It's a big summary of, you know, just the lay of the landscape and what's happening out there. Then there's a technical memo number two, which provides scenarios and more. It's more of a forecasting and what we can expect and where we want to go. And then those two technical memos, even though they're final, they're really considered draft, and then they're combined, if you will, into the draft transit development and coordinated plan that then eventually becomes the final plan. So far, staff have received the first technical memo, which is included as the exhibit in the staff report. Additionally, we've held two stakeholder meetings, which have been really helpful from hearing from agencies and organizations that we don't always hear from. And then we've also conducted a survey to build on the previous two survey efforts back in 2017 and 2018. And so from that little tee off, I'm going to let Mike talk a little bit about more detail and provide some summary of all that material that's in the packet.
Mike Reynolds again. So I am happy to report that the plan is on schedule. We have received resounding feedback from the citizens and other people in the area, both in the CAMPO region and in our neighboring communities. So far we've had two public meetings. The first one was a coordinated human services stakeholders meeting, which saw well over 20 people in attendance from 16 agencies from inside Carson City and from Lang County, Story County, Washoe County, and Lake Tahoe. They all came down and gave us some opinions, let us know, you know, where could we be working together. So that was a really great meeting. And then, of course, we had a second meeting at the Senior Center. There were people there from business owners, a bunch of local folks, a lot of riders from regular fixed route riders, and also people who use our paratransit system. So we were able to get some great feedback from them as well. So that turned out really well. And, of course, Lucia mentioned the survey. We did conduct an online survey in partnership with LSC to get feedback from the general community. We didn't get it quite as many as we were hoping for. We were shooting for 100. We got around 60, which is still a pretty good turnout considering we only, we didn't receive anywhere near that number on the previous surveys. So some good notes about that survey, though, is that, of course, pretty consistent with people want to see more stops, more locations around town. They also want to see some more service more often, you know, see if we can get people around a little faster. And then one of the differences, which is a good note, is that the previous surveys we conducted showed that most people thought that the buses were expensive. We charge a dollar fare, so that was a little unusual. But this survey showed that they did think it was very reasonable. You know, so I think that's a good turn. Of course, if you look in your packets, we did include tech memo number one. On page 83, there's a peer review table. It can be found under the blue headline labeled Performance Measures. It's a summary of how we stack up against five similar agencies around the country. A few of the assumptions that we've been able to make off of this table is that we are using all of our buses. We're running them a lot longer. lot more often, more effectively. We are transporting more people per an hour than most of these other agencies. And, of course, our cost per passenger trip is less than half of the nearest of these piers. So we're really cost effective, and we're using our resources well is essentially what comes out of that. I do want to close by giving kudos to LSC for their hard work and their dedication to this plan. They've been really working hard to meet the deadlines that we've set, and I'm really excited to see what they're going to come out with the next technology.
Any questions?
Just a comment. If you go to page 33, which is the packet number 67, I assume that we don't really have a bus with 2.8 million miles on it.
Good catch. Supervisor Bagwell also caught that. That was a fat finger with an extra one in there. So it's 281,093. That will be corrected before when it gets incorporated into the plan.
Can we buy more buses that will do 2.8 million miles? Hey,
we were hoping for the type of...
Mike is researching that currently. We've set the expectations really high.
2.8. Any other questions? John? Oops.
I was wondering if there was any desire for, say, like Route 3 to go up to Trader Joe's in the Walmart area up there.
So, yes, that is going to be discussed in the next tech memo. That's one of the things that we're looking at to see what the affordability would be and, you know, if that would be something reasonable for us to do. It is one of the big points that all the surveys and all the public comments that we've received, those are it's probably one of the biggest interests. So it is something we are definitely looking at.
Did you have a comment?
Just I wanted to comment a little bit on the data that deals with the population and that everyone was actually understanding the footnote. And so that oftentimes I find we have all these different reports. Well, and every time I turn around, it's one is using this report and methodology and population, and this one's using that, and it seems to me that maybe we should look, I don't know, maybe there's a process or something, we look to say, hey, pick whichever model we're going to use, whether it's census information, Department of Taxation information, adjusted, but that we gain a consistency, because I think the public sometimes thinks we're making the statistics fit wherever we need to go, because you go pull the table that fits your need. So I just wanted to, because I noted on there that it indicated it had been adjusted by the vendor, by LSC. And so I didn't know what they adjusted, because I was like, wow, I didn't recognize that Douglas County would be losing population. So Just a comment, and that maybe that's just something internally we look at or work towards, you know, that, wow, all these vendors pick a different model. So just.
I will comment that I had a conversation with LSC this morning regarding those numbers, and so we are going to, well before the final draft is made, we're going to look at making a solid model for all of the following tech memos and things. So.
Any other questions? I just had one. I liked seeing that analysis that showed the different costs from different service areas. I thought that really enlightened the cost and really showed when people ask, you know, how much does this cost? And then I was just curious how they picked those places. How did they roll some dice? Are these places they've already worked maybe?
I would say that's a little bit of both. These are areas that they're familiar with, maybe personally or otherwise. They have similar populations or transit costs. So, you know, that's all public knowledge. You can get that off of FDA sites and that sort of thing.
Thank
so,
you. I should have read that.
I believe that's how they chose them.
Thank you. Actually, it's on the same page. Brad just pointed out to me that I paid a lot of attention to the chart, which shows what my brain works like, but I missed the sentence above it that described where those items came from. So they tell how they pick those places, which makes a lot of sense. So that's just really good. That's the first time I've seen a comparison all these years sitting here that shows that Jack's doing a good job in this community. Anybody from the public like to come forward to speak to this item? Seeing none, it's a no action item. So we move down the agenda a little farther. Future agenda items, 7A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we are on schedule for the JAC Transit Development Coordinated Plan for receiving the draft plan in July. That said, I don't know if we'll receive it in time to get it into the July packet due to the packet deadlines, though we're targeting to at the very least have a tech memo too for you all for July. So that's on the agenda. We are looking at a functional class change for a couple of roads in Douglas County, so that's on the agenda, as well as an update of our public participation plan. If you have not seen it, the public participation plan is up on our website, open for a 45-day public comment period. The intent of the amendment is to really modernize it, incorporate some more modern means of outreach and public participation. So if any of you have any additional comments or any members of the public in the meantime, staff are eager to incorporate them.
Can you send an email out?
Absolutely.
Just
I can do that.
Help me
with
the better
hyperlink
than the chart the... helped me tonight for the other item.
Absolutely. I will do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. All right. Move to 8, board comments. I'll start on the right. Sandra?
Well, I'm feeling like I have to say something because I don't think I did last month, so I'm like racking my brain. So last November, we approved the One Nevada Transportation Plan, which is our statewide long-range transportation plan. We're currently negotiating with a consultant to help us implement that plan, which includes, some of these performance measures that were talked about earlier today and integrating, making a true performance-based planning and prioritization process and ideally eventually make that as seamless as possible with our metropolitan planning organizations as well. So we work very well with CAMPO and the other MPOs in the state for some consistency in how we're measuring things, how we're reporting things, our projections in terms of forecasting both on the revenue as well as the need side. So that's all I have. I had to come up with something.
That's a big deal, actually.
It is.
How does STACK work with that new program?
So the STACK no longer exists.
Oh, I wondered. Okay.
It's been replaced by the TPAC, Transportation Planning Advisory Committee. So the STACK used to stand for State Transportation Technical Advisory Committee. And part of that, we sort of rebranded it. It's a lot of the same members, but that Technical Advisory Committee, I think, got a little confusing because it's not actually transportation technical experts. So we've changed that to a planning advisory committee. So that group is actually the steering committee for the One Nevada plan as well as other planning processes. And that was part of the rebranding. There's some confusion about who they're advisory to and what technical expertise were necessary. And so we clarified that they're actually a planning advisory committee to NDOT planning for things such as the One Nevada plan, corridor studies, things like that. So we use them as much as possible as depending on what we're working on, either technical or planning advisory committee, to make sure we're integrating many of our partners. And for those of you who don't know, that includes, it does include the MPOs. It also includes a lot of the federal agencies, state agencies. It's really a broad ranging group that's fairly non-typical for state DOTs to have a diverse group like that helping advise us in planning. So
is there a CAMPO rep as an MPO on that group?
Yes. Is that you? Yeah, it's been a little while since we've met, so yeah.
Oh, great.
And in addition to that, we also have the PEG, the Planning Executive Group, which is really which is now the Technical Advisory Committee. So that's NDOT, the MPOs, and Federal Highway Administration. That's where we get into the gory details of the performance metrics, planning agreements, forecasting assumptions, things like that, and then the TPAC helps advise on the broader policy framework.
Well, that's a lot of changes then. That's great. John, do you have any comments? Jess, Brad? No. Greg? Right? No. We went easy there.
We're getting done fast. We have graduation tonight.
Oh. Are you just getting out of high school? Or?
I have a whole lot of kids in my community, and I go every year.
So. I bet. That's a great celebration, actually. So we're done with that. So the next meeting is scheduled July 10th here in this room at 4:30. And close this out with one more chance for the public. Anybody want to come forward to say anything to Campo here tonight? Seeing none, I call for a motion for adjournment. Did I hear so moved? John called for it. What time do you want to bring back RTC? 5 o'clock. Thank you, everybody.
Well, that's where I tune in on. Oh, man.
I know, I couldn't figure it out. I haven't.
Yeah, I know, I looked at it. It's the wrong thing.
I was not going to have it. I was on Campo.
Sorry,
my bad. I have to
say it. So, it's Campo, the right brand, and RTC, the left brand, or
the right brand? One brand.
Or one, yeah.
On the numbers for the census, we started to use RTC.
Thank you.
Welcome. I'd like to call to order this meeting of the Carson City Regional Transportation Commission. It is June 12, 2019. It is 5 o'clock straight up. We are at in the Sierra Room at 851 East Williams Street. Kathy, can we have a roll call, please?
Chairperson Bonkowski.
Here.
Vice Chairperson Kimbrough.
Here.
Commissioner Bagwell.
Here.
Commissioner McQuarrie.
Here.
Commissioner Stebfield.
Here.
Quorum is present.
Thank you, Kathy. Any changes to the agenda tonight?
No, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any disclosures by any of the members of the commission on any of the items? All right, moving right along, we are on agenda item number four, first public comment. Anybody out in the public that has any comment for us tonight other than on the action items that we will be addressing? I see nobody approaching, so we will continue on to item five, approval of the minutes. If the commissioners had a chance to look over the minutes, I will entertain questions or a motion.
I make a motion that we approve the minutes for May 8th.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. Passes unanimously. We are now on agenda item 6A for possible action. Discussion and possible action regarding cooperative agreement number PR 279-19-063 between the Carson City RTC and the Nevada Department of Transportation for $1,618,000 for the design and construction of a multi-use path along I-580 from Colorado Street to the Pete Livermore Sports Complex, and authorizing the transportation manager to execute the agreement and future amendments regarding term extensions or a change in amount up to 10%. And Dirk, this one's yours.
Thank you, Chair. So I'll start with a little background. In January of 2018, the RTC approved pursuit of a $1.6 million grant for the design and construction of a multi-use path that runs along I-580, starting at Colorado Street, traveling south to the Pete Livermore Sports Complex. It's approximately 1.8 miles in length. The path is entirely contained within the NDOT freeway right-of-way, which is a benefit. Starting at Colorado Street, the path is located on the western side of the freeway. It approaches Clearview Drive, and that's where they transition to the eastern side, and then it continues on to the sports complex. The grant and the proposed alignment are in line with the Carson City Freeway Multi-Use Path Alignment Study from 2011. This is a typical agreement with NDOT, Nevada Department of Transportation. This is committing the city to the required 5% local match, which is just under $81,000, and it's also committing Carson City's resources to delivery of the project. As noted in the staff report, in March of 2019, staff did meet with two property owners. They did have concerns of the proposed path. The concerns focused on fire and security danger, and I've clearly noted those in the staff report. Staff does feel that these concerns can be addressed during the design process, but if this agreement is approved, it's initiating the design phase of the project, which means all public comments received will be able to influence design for a better project. The city, after we received those comments, city staff reached out to other departments within the city, such as the Sheriff's Office, Fire Department, and Parks, to try and get an understanding of what's going on, the existing trail system that we have. So that's also noted in the staff report. I want to mention that after we met with the property owners, and they raised a concern about fire with regards to fuel that was accumulating in this kind of dead area right now between the sound wall and the fencing. Since then, I'm happy to report the project manager, Rob Fellows, and the fire department did reach out to NDOT, who has gone out there and reduced the fuels. I did provide late material that shows a picture of the path. It is slightly labeled incorrectly because I was thinking of the Campo meeting, but it's actually for the RTC, so we'll fix that, and we'll put that late material on the website. But that is a picture that was taken today by the project manager, Rob Fellows, and shows that it's pretty cleaned up right now. If the agreement is approved, design is anticipated to start in early fall. And that concludes my comments. Rob Fellows, again, is a project manager, and he's here. I think he has some comments on the project.
Yes, I do. This is Rob Fellows. I'm the project manager for this multi-use path. I just wanted to go over some of the particulars of the alignment. Obviously, the west side has a major sound wall, and NDOT did leave us a little bit of room between the sound wall and the property line to get through. Most of it is average 15 feet, so it's going to be tight. There are a few obstacles to avoid near Clearview. Mainly a meter, power meter, that kind of thing, and maybe a telephone vault lid. Got some obstructions there, but nothing major. As we cross over to Clearview and get on the east side, there's actually a lot more room to maneuver on that side. And then, of course, once we get into the Livermore Sports Complex, we're going to run along that east side, but not right along where the property owners are. We're going to balance that and not interfere with the future plans of the park, but connect to that major road that goes into the facility. So I'm here to answer any questions about any part of the design or any questions you may have on something else.
Rob, where the path goes under I-580 at Clearview, what's that going to look like? Is that an underpass?
Well, it's actually accommodated on the overpass. When they did the design for the freeway, they did leave room for bike lanes on the overpass, and they also did do the pedestrian ramps wide enough to accommodate the bicycle, so there's really no improvements that we need to do on that overpass.
Do we have questions from the commission? We'll start with Mark, then go to Chaz.
Got to hook up the mic here. You know, Rob, I was informed a long time ago working on a trail over by the hospital that part of the I-580 project, once it's completed, which it is, they have to fence the entire right-of-way, some way. So when that guy's talking about barbed wire, I can see the chain link along there, but it doesn't look like that's the final. Is that the final fencing so that we don't have to talk about barbed wire, essentially? It'd be chain link, I think, is what.
Currently, it's chain link along most of that. There is some gates. There are actually two gates
into people's private property.
Yes, that are through the fence. Huh. But a lot of the fence is actually double fenced. The city has an easement, a 15-foot drainage easement, along the backs of those properties, and so a lot of the personal fence has been set back that 15 feet, and then there's a drainage feature along that whole edge of I-580. That, you know, we're gonna utilize for our drainage. That's what it was meant to do.
So is that chain link NDOT's then?
That is on the right of way. That's NDOT fence.
Okay, so that's one of the things that may happen. Yeah. You can't borrow a little bit of that drainage for your path?
Certainly, it'd be nice to have a little bit of that, but there's so much behind there that's kind of been overtaken, and I think it would be expensive.
Moving the fence?
Yeah, it would be expensive to go into there. But certainly the drainage could, some of the drainage could use that. And so we could, you know, get a good, because we're only going to go 3 feet off of the sound wall, and we've got a 10-foot path, and then the remainder is going to be on the west side.
Pavement 3 foot from the wall, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, clearance. So we have our shoulder, and then we're going to have a 10-foot path, and then the difference, whatever that is. We've also got those big power poles on that side, too, to get around.
Thanks. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'm really pleased to see this thing moving forward, finally. From my perspective, everything seems to move at a glacial speed when it comes to working with other agencies. But I'm really glad to see it going forward. I am curious that the final leg of the path along the freeway corridor would extend it on the south side of the freeway past the Indian Colony to tie in at Old Clear Creek Road. Well, actually the frontage road before you get to Old Clear Creek Road. So I guess, is there any plans to apply for another grant to complete that last bit?
We have been talking about that, and that's the plan, is to progress towards what the alignment study had talked about, and also have a leg that goes south to connect into the Bigelow improvements that have been done recently with that subdivision.
Okay. And then I'm sure you've thought about this, and I don't know whether park operations influence exactly where you put it when it goes south within the park, but you might keep that future extension in mind and maybe have it on the south side of the freeway for longer before you tie it into the access road to the park. Just a thought that would help going forward.
No, that's good. I mean, I always like to know what their plans are and make sure they leave enough room for us, or we're looking at all the future plans there. Originally, I wanted to extend it further, but we decided to change that. So anyway, I was already looking at going further to the west.
All right.
Something to add on that is that we have talked with David Navarro, who's in charge of parks maintenance, and we've also worked with Jen Budge. They are working, and Vern Cron, the senior park planner. They do have some plans coming up in the future, so we have started those discussions. They know that this project is moving forward. One of the comments that we received from them was, right now, I think, if I remember correctly, there's a gate, and they do close the sports complex at night, and so the thought is to make sure that this path has some type of parking or accessibility after hours, because so that it folks don't get closed in by a gate from a vehicle standpoint if they're parking to use a trail.
I didn't know that was going to happen. I was just driving on Bigelow the other day and saw they put the bike lanes in. Oh, that's really nice. That brings that whole subdivision dead ends it down there on, which is a bummer. So does the city have access to come in the backside of Livermore Park down in there off of Bigelow so they could look at crossing the street there and getting to the same spot? I mean, there's a dirt road you can sneak in sometimes to get to the...
There's tribal land.
That's all tribal there.
Yeah, but there is, you know, and Ms. Maloney and I were talking today about it, but the Bigelow right-of-way does exist, so there might be some opportunities with that in the future. The TAP grant that we believe is coming out this fall, so as we kind of progress in this project, we can start actually working on another grant application and figure out kind of how to lay out the next alignment of the path. And so maybe we'll have some stuff in the near future.
So the path, is it going to be asphalt with DG shoulders? Is that the anticipation?
Yeah, aggregate base shoulders and asphalt 3-on-6.
So the fuel is a moot point then?
That whole area between the sound wall and the fence will be clear of vegetation, and they need to keep it clear. I was just back there today, obviously took pictures and saw some noxious weeds and some other things that were on the private side in the easement. And we have those type of easements all over the city where we have drainages behind homes and so forth, and we work with code enforcement and to keep those clear, and we've got, you know, lots of things to do with that around the city.
Just to clarify that for me, you know, when you have paths like that that are paved and have a shoulder, if he uses fill material like DG, then the equestrians and the runners can use it. Runners would rather run on the dirt on the side than on the blacktop. So you said aggregate, so I wondered if it still has that possibility to be used as a parallel trail for equestrians and runners, maybe, so without limiting it.
You know, the aggregate base, type 2 aggregate base, has, you know, it does have some rocks in it, but it also has some fines in it, too. And we've been using it throughout the paths, for all of the paths, except for the ones down that are trails, like in Riverview Park. Haven't had any issue with it. A lot of times the gravel seems to roll off and is at the edge, and it's not really near the pavement. But DG, I mean, that's certainly an option if that's something that's desired.
Well, that's what you see. Some of the trails have been at the DG surface. It's easier if you compact the right, and it doesn't seem like there'd be a big drainage problem in there. But engineers will speak to that. Maybe Chaz might not be excited about DG, but just a comment that aggregate's a little harder to run on sometimes.
Yeah. The DG tends to reel, and you'll get these reels next to the path. In fact, we used DG next to the one near our office, and you can see that it's fairly steep, but it's coming off, and so it's not – in the right situation, it works great, but if you got a steep slope, it tends to move on you.
And you haven't seen a problem with the fines in the type 2 washing?
Haven't seen any issue with using the type 2 base, yeah, for the shoulder.
Any additional questions? Right. We'll open this up to public comment. Come on up, have a seat at the table, press the button on the mic so the green light comes on, and then identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Clint Borges. My property is at 1791 Coons Lane. A little backstory. Before there was construction of the freeway, we didn't have any pedestrian path or any pedestrian access, actually. And after they came through and they took out all the sagebrush, then we started getting pedestrians walking through, which was fine. But then they started picking up rocks, and they broke out 3 of my windows of my barn and 1 of my garden shed. I'm not one of the ones that have this offset. My fence is right against the path. And all it is a chain link fence. There's my chain link fence, and then there's the NDOT's chain link fence. But it's transparent, so you can see through it. What I would like to see is some kind of solid fence where they don't see the windows where they're throwing rocks at them is what my concern is. And just curious, are you going to have, like, crosswalks for that path then? And then... It would be nice, since there's the walkway at the end of Coons and you go up into the mountains, and we get lots of pedestrians, and there's no crosswalks that ever go across there. I know that's off tangent, but it seems silly that there's nothing there, but that's just another off tangent note. But that'd be my comment. I'd like to see some kind of fencing that's solid. So they just, because my garden shed and the barn, you can see from the freeway, it's a red one. And it's the only thing you can see, but that it's real close. It's the 15-foot offset, I think. Isn't that right? 20 foot. So it's pretty close.
So if I could ask a favor, if you could submit those comments in writing to us, as was mentioned earlier, the comments will be taken into account during the design phase.
Yeah, I didn't receive anything for comments or anything.
But we'll make sure that you have our contact information so that you can submit the comments so we can get them into the record.
All right. Okay. Sounds good. Thanks.
Thank you. Is there any other public comment on this item? All right. Seeing none, I will bring this item back to the commission and entertain a motion.
away from you. I'm like, oh, that's what he is.
I move to approve the cooperative agreement as presented and to authorize the transportation manager to execute the agreement and specified future amendments.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. Passes 5-0. We are now on agenda item 6B. For possible action, discussion and possible action to determine that NBNJ Construction Group, Inc. is the lowest responsive and responsible bidder pursuant to NRS Chapter 338 and to award contract number 1819-237, CDBG College Parkway ADA Improvements Project to NBNJ Construction Group, Inc. for a total not to exceed amount of $222,849. And Mr. Stecky?
Tom Grundy, project manager, will take this item.
I'm Tom Grundy.
Thanks, Tom.
With Carson City Public Works. And a little bit about the project. The project is on College Parkway between North Carson Street and Northgate Lane. It includes removing existing curb gutter sidewalk and AC paving and installing new curb ramps and concrete driveway aprons. And there's some sidewalk, too, that's in poor condition. It's lifted, and some of that's being replaced. It's a total of about 10 ramps. And we are coordinating this project with the District 1 slurry seal, which is a separate project. We're doing this out ahead of it, so all that stays coordinated. The bid tabs are included in the staff report, and like you said, the lowest responsive and responsible bidder is NBNJ Construction, and we are recommending that all three additive alternates be awarded, which is a Burger King driveway, the Porticeps driveway, and the 7-Eleven driveway. So I could answer any questions.
So on those three driveways under the additive alternative bids, are we going to be reimbursed for those from the businesses, or is the city planning on bearing the cost of those replacements?
Dirk Horn for the record, the city is going to be bearing the cost. This is part of the CDBG grant. This corridor is part of our ADA transition plan. These areas were identified and they were submitted as part of the grant to community development block grants, and so they are included in the grant, which is 100% funded by CDBG funds.
The driveways are the responsibility of the businesses, correct?
I know usually when we deal with capital projects, we do not address the commercial driveways because we kind of limit the scope to the intersections. I think based on the fact that these are part of the transition plan, we looked at these a little slightly different. This is part of a transit route, and so we kind of felt that these were important when we were scoping out the project. But I think your comment's accurate.
So my concern is that I was approached by a business the other day who was interested in something similar. It's going to be on the South Carson project, and they would like some maybe custom design of their driveway. They want to widen the driveway cut and replace it. And they wanted to know if the city would incorporate that into the design. And so I indicated to them that they would need to come to the city, work with our engineers and designers to show us what it was that they wanted, and that I felt that they would then be back charged for the difference between what the project was intended to cover and any changes to that design. So my concern here is whether or not we're going to be accused of favoritism by taking care of the costs for these three businesses when we're not offering that to the other businesses along this project or in other projects in town. So I don't know if you can address that at this time, but I mean, that's a concern to me if there's a perception of favoritism or that we're not being equal to all property owners.
I think good reason why we went to on this approach from a past practice. For South Carson, I know we are looking and have been talking with a lot of private property owners, so we are coordinating, and some of it has to do with budget availability. A lot of the commercial driveways got improved when NDOT came up and did the micro seal before they handed the road over to the city. But we are looking at trying to make some access improvements on South Carson. I think the best, my recommendation, and someone correct me if I'm wrong, is that they should reach out to us and we should have that discussion, because I think it's worth looking into.
Go ahead, Lucia, and then Lori.
If I may ask, staff did ask me when we were scoping this project, and we did have this discussion. There are some circumstances in town where, you know, the nature of the transportation network, what Dirk alluded to with the transit route and the transit stops, where, you know, staff, you know, the private property owner may or may not do their driveway, and we may or may not have any ability as a city to force them to redo their driveway, but where there is a need and a purpose to for the city to improve that route for that sidewalk, for so people can connect. So in this case, I did advise staff that it was important to include it. That said, we did bid it as an added alternate, and so there is flexibility there should RTC consider to exercise that.
So I think part on this one for me, if I recall, too, the driveways are really integral to the access for the residents in the low-income area that live there to be able to. It's probably the actual area in town that I see on a regular basis. People in wheelchairs and things like that, actually going across the street to the grocery store there and coming back, heavily used. So I think part of the driveway correction here is really an ADA issue that necessarily the regular owner wouldn't fix in their driveway. I mean, I'm surprised how much wheelchair access I see going across there to the grocery store. It really shocks me when I go to make a right-hand turn how almost always there's someone from that apartment complex and stuff using that. So,
and that was the rationale that staff provided.
Grant itself.
And that's what we discussed really to continue and make that route ADA accessible.
Here's a question. Are these driveways being replaced in kind?
Yeah, not enhancing them.
They're, when you say in kind as a local part of a local match, or when you say in kind.
In other words, you're taking out what's there and you're putting back what was there, only it's new.
In most cases, the driveways aren't ADA compliant, so they're putting back to a design that does comply. If I remember correctly, I believe one of the 7-Eleven driveways is actually going away, and that's because it's not being used as it once was with garbage disposal.
So essentially, yes, but making sure that the ADA is there. So that kind of speaks to your question, you know, when you told them that they would be back charged for any enhancements above and beyond what they have. So maybe that's what I was driving at with that question, is you're basically getting like for like on this project. Thank you.
Follow up on Lori. I live about two blocks from there, so I see that all the time, and they have trouble catching the light all the way sometimes. And one day I went by there, and this poor lady in one of those scooter cars couldn't get up the curb.
Right.
And she sat there stuck, so all the cars stopped, got out, went over, and pushed her up on the curb. So that showed a definite problem if the regular scooters would be all right and couldn't get up the curb, and she's half in the lane of traffic struggling. And so just a more feedback on that. That ADA is actually necessary for that site. It was the Burger King one that she was in trouble.
So again, though, my concern is not whether or not these improvements are necessary. It's who should be paying for them. And I'm very concerned that we'd be setting a precedent here that's going to come back to bite us. So if any of the commissioners have any thoughts on that, I'd appreciate hearing them. I have no problem voting for the project to be done. I have not decided yet on the additive alternatives, just for that one reason, on who pays for them.
I think I'm basically echoing Commissioner Steadfield's comment that if you're not actually making access wider or deeper, but you're replacing an access that is necessary to comply with ADA as part of a program, then it's appropriate that the city pay for that. If, on the other hand, as in this other case you mentioned on South Carson Street, they want an enhanced driveway, wider, some other features, then it seems appropriate to me that they should pay their portion for that additional facility. They've got increased value, and that is what they should pay for, but not the basic construction that would be required as part of the project. I mean, that's the way I've looked at it in the past, anyway.
Other comments? Go ahead, Mark.
Just for the record, I'll support Greg and Chaz both, actually, from having seen that problem, that they can be bad driveways.
So I guess I kind of fall right in between, because I so let's talk about a non-grant project, right? So let's just say we're doing a street project, and so the first part that bothered me is to hear that the city doesn't feel like it really has any teeth to require someone. So let's say my driveway, and it's a commercial one, is full of potholes, and people are going across in their wheelchairs. So we have no teeth whatsoever to require the maintenance. There's no maintenance requirement of, like, your sidewalk and your things like that. There's a trip fall hazard. We have no teeth.
We do have teeth when it comes to that. I think the ramps in this case have to do with the slope. Correct me if I'm wrong, and where the slope is greater than the ADA, the 2% cross slope or the slope, that where it's in perfectly functional condition, it's really hard sometimes to ask the property owner to, you know, change their slopes. To Supervisor Bonkowski's point, there are cases where, you know, we do our best to make everything ADA standard, but the case we discussed just yesterday at staff level was the Airport Road utility project, right? And there's driveways along Airport Road over by Menlo, and it's simply not in the budget to do all of those driveways to make those ADA accessible. And so as staff, there's trade-offs on when we can fund it and when we can't. In this case, I did make the call to include it as an additive alternate to see if we could do it. There is grant money available. It's 100% funded. But you're absolutely right. It's been inconsistent in the application only because there's simply not enough money to do everything. So we're doing it as best and as fast as we can do.
But we're not requiring the people on the Menlo Manor area. They don't have to put in the money just because we couldn't find the money. That's really
correct.
I'm with Brad on that. I just want to make sure we're consistent and I don't go and force a property owner to do something that I didn't force this guy to do. And as long as we have equal enforcement of our rules, I'm okay with saying that this is an ADA project.
That's
and
correct.
Therefore we're...
It's an ADA project with demonstrated use right. On the facility.
A couple of thoughts. First off, typically when you have a situation like that, the city doesn't get involved until somebody comes in with an application to the planning department, and then they're required to bring things up to code. If they don't touch it, they aren't required to touch it. The other thing that gets a little bit sticky in my experience as an engineer is that typically the right-of-way is at the back of walk, yeah. Right? So, but if I'm not mistaken, the property owner is responsible for the sidewalk. So it's just one of those really weird situations, you know, but I still believe that if they're not doing anything other than improving the ADA, they're not asking for, like Chaz said, wider, better, you know, stamp-colored concrete, those kinds of things, I don't think this is setting a precedent when we go to South Carson Street.
One or two more comments. Mr. Grundy, remind me, when we have permits come in, if someone's doing a significant remodel or if commercial development's coming in and they're changing use or upgrading the business, we do require them to upgrade to ADA standards at that time.
And then another thought for your consideration is that when we're out there doing a capital project, it's hard. You always have your project scope, but then we have a sidewalk. In a lot of places, you have a few feet of sidewalk, a driveway, a few feet of sidewalk. So at what point do you stop saw cutting and doing this piecemeal system and just say, I'm just going to replace this amount of driveway? And it is a judgment call. And so I just wanted to offer those off for consideration.
Any additional comments from any of the commissioners? All right, then I'm going to open this up to public comment. Anybody in the public that has any input on this item? I see nobody approaching, so let's bring this back to the commission. You guys tell me what you want to do.
Make a motion. I move to award the contract as presented, which includes all three alternates on the bid.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? And all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. All right, the vote's 5-0. All right, moving on to item 6C for possible action. Discussion and possible action to determine that Sierra Nevada Construction, Inc. is the lowest responsive and responsible bidder pursuant to NRS Chapter 338 and to award contract 1819-224 Gonai Road Reconstruction Project to Sierra Nevada Construction, Inc. for a total not to exceed amount of $432,307.70. Who's taking this one? Tom, go ahead.
And this project is a full-depth reconstruction of Gonai Road between Arrowhead Drive and Boeing Way, and it includes utility adjustments and striping. Bid tabs are included in the staff report. The lowest responsive and responsible bidder was SNC Construction. The bid amount was $393,007. The engineer's estimate was $625,000. And we've done a couple more projects in this area in past years, but this project is separate from those. We're not redoing any work. This is just more work on Gonai Road. So it starts on the north side of Gonai Road and continues north through the intersection of Boeing Way. And I could answer any questions you have.
So normally when we see such a big discrepancy in the bids, the first question we ask is, are we comfortable with this contractor? But we've awarded plenty of bids to Sierra Nevada Construction, so I mean, we've had a good relationship with them, so I'm assuming that Spanish Springs Construction is just a high bid. That's the outlier, not the Sierra Nevada Construction bid, although it's still quite a bit lower than the engineer's estimate. So just assure us that we have no issues with the contractor and that you have some recourse against the contractor if they are not building to our standards.
Yes, so Dan Stuckey, City Engineer, that's a good question. SNC, I mean, based off past experience, they've done a lot of work in this town. They generally do a really good job, so it's not a red flag or anything with them. We have technical specifications in our construction documents that every contractor, when they bid, they have to meet. We have a construction management group. We have an inspector, you know, been on staff for 20 years that's going to be out there every day checking their work and making sure it's done right. And that's a pretty good protection on our end to make sure it's done the way we want it to be done.
Any questions from the commissioners? We'll go with Lori and then Mark.
And when I actually, I think we're probably all on the same answer on what he was looking at, but when I really looked down into the bid itself and the detail, it's really in items 1, 2, and 3, which looks to me to be the removal areas, the huge chunk of dollars and the traffic control. So maybe they just have something different in their plan, because when you get to the piece of the construction, that was 273 versus 295. So that looked pretty consistent. But boy, mobilization, traffic control, and removal of the old pavement was big. So I was a little more comfortable when I saw what sections were so different.
Yeah, I figure, well, I was amazed that you're moving 18 inches of material. That was quite the hump. So there must be some total failure in there. But are you guys saving the pavement? Maybe if you only have to haul it like over to the yard or something, or they have to haul it out to the dump in the aggregate and save the pavement. You guys save pavement once when they reground for projects in the city. Maybe that was a savings that Sierra Nevada had somehow.
Yeah, so typically when it's like a, and Tom can jump in and correct me if I'm wrong, but typically it's like a milling project. A lot of those millings, the grindings and stuff, we'll keep at our public works yard because we can use those for roads. If it's a removal, typically they'll take it and remove it away. And
big chunks. Yeah. Oh, okay. That would make sense. So where did they have to haul that? Someplace, I guess. Yeah, I was surprised at the difference in the bid, too, so I thought maybe they had an inside track of how easy it is to haul all that stuff somewhere. But that's a lot of road. Just threw me 18 inches of aggregate just blew me away. So is there like a total failure of the road there? And the
no, it's just we did a pavement analysis of the structural section that we needed for the pavement replacement, and I think it was, 10 on 6? 12 on 6. Okay, so that's their 18 inches of removal to make room for the 12 inches of base and the 6 inch of asphalt.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe they didn't put any aggregate underneath the pavement originally or some weird thing. So that it's going. Just simple little questions so I become more enlightened here as my representative for the citizens here. Thank you.
Additional comments or questions from the commissioners? Greg?
So on the bid tabs, I noticed that there's nothing in there to process subgrade, which could be a big dollar item. Have we done geotech on this?
The project manager's not here, so I apologize, and I don't know if we have done a geotech analysis. I'm assuming we did. Which we normally would do for these types of projects, but I don't have that answer right in front of me.
Because you know how subgrade can bite you. Even if you punch, you know, the adequate number of holes, you know, you just never know what's going to happen. So, just thought.
So let's follow that through. If the scope of work that we supply to contractors is not complete, then that just goes through a change order process?
Yeah, so we have the contingency amount that would handle that, and it would be a change order.
Any other questions?
You're not going to buy a whole lot for $39,000.
They have to come back here.
They would have to come back for
any additional questions or comments? Any public comment on this item? All right, I'll entertain the motion.
Okay, I move to award the contract as presented.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. The vote is 5-0. We're now on agenda item 6D. For information only, informational presentation and discussion on traffic impacts and expectations resulting from the South Carson Street Complete Streets project. And Lucia, are you taking this? No. You guys are really messing with me tonight. This is
everybody's name.
All the items are different.
All right. Good evening, Board. Dan Stuckey, City Engineer, for the record. Apologies for the delay on that, but we're ready to go. I'm joined. We have Lauren Chilson. He is the principal at Headway Transportation. And then I've got Tom Grundy, who's the project manager for the South Carson Complete Streets project. So Lauren will talk. I'll kind of give an intro on, you know, somewhat of the development of the project. I think it's important. We're here to talk about traffic impacts and the expectations, but there is, it's important to talk a little bit about the background and how we got to this project. And not only with the infrastructure plan of expenditures, but also just the project objectives and the complete streets and really changing the feel of this corridor. And then it's important, I believe, too, to hit on the reductions, the significant reductions that we have seen in that corridor that allow us to do a complete streets type project. I'll go through that. Then I'm going to turn it over to Lauren. He'll talk about the study that was done. You know, as you saw in your agenda, we've done a lot of work on the city end to make sure that this project, the design is optimized to move traffic through in an effective way. And so we hired to Lauren to help us with that and implement some of those changes. And then lastly, I'll talk about the recommendations that Lauren and his team have recommended, how we're implementing that into the design that you see today. So with that, I'll get going. Infrastructure tax, this 1 and 8 cent sales tax, it was adopted by the Board of Supervisors in 2014. And the reason this is important, I wanted to talk about this, is the South Carson Corridor was a part of that project. And the vision of the board and Carson City was at that point to, we had all these corridors that were somewhat neglected as far as aesthetically and from a complete street standpoint, that we wanted to invest money in and make a difference and have these inviting corridors, these complete streets corridors that welcome people to the city, right? And there's some economic, you know, through a lot of studies, there's some economic benefits of a, you know, a complete streets and a more beautiful street. I'm not going to get into that today, but I did highlight the yellow parts because I think it's important to note this is straight from the plan of expenditures. Those are what types of projects the board wanted to do at that point. You can see a lot of those are complete streets types improvements, you know. So that's kind of where we started with this, so 2014. And then we, you know, the NDOT agreement, I think, is another important thing to mention is, you know, with the right-of-way relinquishment, we received some funding from NDOT to do complete streets types of improvements along this corridor. And then, you know, 2016, 2017, we were doing these corridor studies, meeting with the public, voting on certain cross-sections in the city and how we wanted to do this project. So I think it's important to provide that background of really the purpose of this project. And, you know, I want to be clear that, you know, if people are expecting, you know, this big wide open corridor, lots of asphalt where, you know, you can drive through as fast as you can today, that's not what this project is going to be in the future, and that's not what we're designing this project to be. We are strategically designing this project a certain way, and what we ultimately want to do is transform it into a safer street, a more aesthetically pleasing street, a street for all users, including motorists, including pedestrians, and including cyclists. And I know you guys have seen this before. I don't need to go through all the features here, but I do think these project objectives that we're implementing into the design are straight basically from that plan of expenditures that I showed you on the previous slide. We're enhancing business access by the removal of median. We're increasing safety through enhanced street lighting. We're adding crosswalk, safer crosswalk, flashing beacon, crosswalk type features, adding bike lanes, multi-use path. We also, one of the goals of this project was to essentially extend downtown south of 5th to Stewart, kind of extend that downtown feel and have some sort of transitional feature at Stewart Street, which we're doing with the roundabout. And then, you know, the last bullet there is not really applicable to traffic, but there are significant investments in utility and smart city advancements with this project. So I wanted to hit with that. So I don't think this should come as a shock to anybody, but we are doing lane reductions. And today, you know, Lauren's going to talk about how we've analyzed to make sure this functions as an effective complete streets. But really what allows us to do these lane reductions is the traffic reductions that we have seen through the extension of the freeway. When this was first formulated, this project, back in, you know, 2013, 2014, anticipating that freeway opening, the extension from William down to 50, Fairview to 50, it was based off realizing a 40% reduction in traffic. So I wanted to show you a slide. Obviously, we've observed these traffics. We want to make sure observe these volumes to make sure that they're realized so we can move forward this project. But you can see significant reductions. I pulled some traffic count data. This is supplied by the Department of Transportation. In the figure on the right, you'll see two red dots. One of them, the northernmost dot, is South Carson at Kuntz Station. We've seen a 44% reduction, so exceeding that initial 40% reduction from 44,000 vehicles per day down to about 24,500, what you see today. Appian, which is the station there on the south, 50% reduction, 52,000 down to 25,900. So that's the south of Fairview stations, but I also wanted to talk about the north of Fairview stations. And really, what I want to point out here is how this street was initially built. You guys know that the freeway used to come through the middle of downtown. And so this section north of Fairview saw its reductions a little earlier because of the extension from William to Fairview that happened in 2009. But I wanted to kind of show the difference between 2009, the current lane configuration that it's designed for, that it's designed for today, what the volumes were in 2009 and what they are today. So the northernmost point there is the station at 8th Street. 60% reduction, 30,000 vehicles per day down to 12,000 vehicles per day. And then you can see the southernmost dot on that point is at Stewart Street and a 53% reduction from 2009 to 2018. So, you know, this is something I think that's interesting to talk about. I'm not necessarily justifying that it should have been four lanes and a center turn lane back in 2001 when there was 44,000 vehicles per day, but I think it is important to point out the history of what's gone through that corridor. At one point prior to 2002, it was a four lane plus a center turn lane configuration, which is what it will be after this project is designed and constructed. Back in 2001 at the Coons Lane station, it was 43,500 vehicles per day. And if you go back to my slide here, I should have put it on, I apologize for that, but today we're at 24,500 vehicles per day. So, I mean, you can see that it was about 78% more traffic volume than what we see today on a four-lane center turn lane configuration. So then the question is, well, okay, that's today, but how about forecasts? How about in the future, right? So Lauren will talk a little bit more, and they did a lot of modeling on their end as far as forecasting volumes in the future. But at the Coons Lane station in 2040, they're forecasting 32,600, and he'll get into kind of the inputs of that forecasting, but it's still 25% less than what it was saw in 2001. So I thought that was important to point out just from a background standpoint. The other question we get a lot, and I think the purpose of this presentation, again, Lauren will go into a lot of the details, but oftentimes I think it's effective to tell residents and people that are visiting these businesses to try to give them a feel for what the corridor may look like after the project is complete, something that they drive on maybe every day now. And I mean, Lauren probably get into a lot more detail as far as, you know, no street is exactly comparable. They all have their own unique features. But I feel like the William Street comparison is an actually pretty decent comparison. It's a commercial corridor similar to South Carson Street. It's got a four lane plus a center turn lane configuration. It's about 40 miles per hour speed limit, similar to what the most of South Carson Street will be after the project. And then it's got a traffic volume between about 18,000 at Roop Street and about 26,000 by the interchange. So that stretch there, if you remember back on the earlier slides, Stewart Street was about 20,000 in 2018, so that you can compare to the Roop Street count. And then at Coons Lane, it was about 24,000. You can see closer to the interstate there, it's about 25,500. So just to kind of give you a feel of what it might feel like to drive through. It's going to look a lot better than William Street, but it's going to feel driving somewhat like William Street immediately after the project. So I'll turn it over to Lauren here. But the city, I just wanted to give kind of a scope of work that we asked Headway to do. December 2018, we had the 30% design done, and we turned that over to Lauren, and we said, hey, review this. Tell us what design improvements we can do to optimize from a traffic standpoint now and into the future. So with that, they assisted with identifying necessary lane configuration improvements at intersections, so decel lanes and other left turn pockets, other features like that. They also conducted new data collection of peak hour volumes at 14 of the intersections, the major intersections along the corridor. And that did include, there's less than 14 signalized intersections. So it's signalized intersections, it's other intersections, even some of the major driveways there. Travel forecasting, as I mentioned, for existing and build-out conditions, and then calculating a level of service for existing and build-out conditions. And then ultimately, what we wanted out of the report, again, was them to provide recommendations of things we can implement into the design today to make this function really well in the future. So with that, I'll turn it over to Lauren.
Thanks, Dan. Good evening. So our charge was really to identify the ultimate lane configuration and make those recommendations based on a long-range forecast that's as comprehensive as we could really develop. And so what we did was look at a 2040 horizon and a 20-year forecast is fairly typical in the industry. It gets pretty difficult beyond 20 years to predict the future. But in order to make sure that we provided a conservative analysis, we used typical background growth that's experienced in the city and projected in the travel demand model. On top of that, we added seven projects that are recently approved, known, or highly anticipated in the Appian Way area. specifically, as those sit right on the corridor in the section we're talking about. But those include Carson Hills Apartments, the Cochise Multifamily. There's a Appian Commercial Project in that area, which some of you are familiar with. And we also included an approved specific plan that's at the very north end of Douglas County, pardon me, called North Douglas County Specific Plan, interesting name, right? But and that's a fairly large project. There are some long-term approvals there. That project's in a state of revision, and so we use the most current, which is a little less intense than what's currently approved, but still a really significant project, one that would generate on the order of 10,000 ADT. Now, that wouldn't all go up North Carson Street. That's going to spread out to the freeway and many other places, but it's a significant project. It's been included. We evaluated both the morning and evening peak commute hours in that 2040 horizon and using the 30% design plans that were provided so that we could check those and make some recommendations. So what do we measure these traffic volumes against? Well, the city has a policy level of service D, which is a measure of effectiveness that says here's how we would like traffic to flow in general terms. It actually equates to a number of seconds of delay per vehicle on average at intersections. And I'll get into this in the next bullet point just a little bit, but at unsignalized intersections, level service D means vehicles would be 35 seconds or less delay. Pretty low number ultimately. And so the city's policy doesn't exactly or specifically talk about side streets on major arterials. It says, in a global perspective, we want level of service D. But it doesn't say we're going to do that at every left turn movement on a major arterial. Because stop and think about this for a second. If you can have any delay on a side street, every intersection on a major arterial would need to be signalized, and we don't want to go there, right? And we would create gridlock. It's not appropriate. We can't fund those kinds of level of improvements, and they're simply not appropriate. So most communities have said, we understand we want to provide level service D on the whole, but there are going to be movements and time periods and conditions where that is really not practical. And so we're going to accept higher delays, and those may be classified as E or F, because F is at 50 seconds. Well, still, that's less than a minute, and on a busy street during the peak rush hour, when you only make a left turn, that's not an unreasonable delay. So understand that in the big picture here of D is not really achievable on every side street, on every driveway. No city tries to achieve that in the ultimate goals, but I want to point that out because it is a key factor. Next slide, please. So through that analysis of the 14 intersections, we first evaluated the existing traffic volumes, but with the new configuration, and we found that all of the signalized intersection would still function at level service D or better within the city's policy. Side streets would have delay beyond level service D, as I just mentioned, but typically, as it sits today, those volumes from those side streets are pretty low. Volumes that don't meet signal warrants, that don't meet criteria for improvements, and therefore delay on those driveways and side streets is effectively accepted. It's reasonable in this case. In the 20-year horizon, which is, again, a fairly conservative analysis because we're talking about build-out of everything we're aware of plus background growth, that's everything in the model plus, and 20 years out, we find that with the configuration that was proposed at 30%, signalized intersections would again function within policy level service, D or better. Side streets would again, of course, incur delay beyond the D level at E and F, but would be significantly more difficult than they would be under existing traffic volumes because we're talking about some significant growth over time in that conservative analysis. But I want to be crystal clear. Some of those delays will be significant at certain locations that people will effectively have to make a right turn, go up the street, and make a U-turn. They will be that significant. Okay? There will be over a minute. In some locations, there could be 2 minutes of delay, or simply people give up. That won't be every driveway. That won't be every intersection, but it's maybe half a dozen or so in the quarter where folks will choose to make, in 2040, at that build-out level, will choose to choose another route. So what do we do about that? How do we address that? Because the goal of the project is still to create an atmosphere. It's to change the character of the street. It's not to put the vehicles as number one. So what do we do? And so we came up with a number of measures I'll call proactive because we're putting these out in front of the project before it's implemented so we make sure that this is done well. you know, the biggest one, I'll jump down in the bullets a little bit. The biggest one here is really U-turns. The opportunity to have a wide enough street so that people can make U-turns if they feel that delay is too much and they feel unsafe trying to find a small gap to make a left turn, go up the street a block or two to the next signal and make a U-turn. Well, the design needs to make sure that that's possible. There's some other opportunities here, really, and that's to reduce speed limits. So when we change the street character, when we redesign a roadway, it gives us an opportunity to relook at speed limits because we have intentionally changed the design and character. And we're suggesting that 5th to Stewart could be a portion of that is already 25, but the rest of it could be reduced to 25 miles per hour. Stewart to Clearview would probably be appropriate at 35 as a starting point. A lot of that is currently 45. And then Clearview to Appian is really a transition zone south to the freeway and beyond where it's 55. Most of that's 50 existing. Probably should stay in that same range as it's that transition zone between 55 plus and 35. We found that the roundabout configuration that was proposed at Stewart Street should really be widened to have two westbound to southbound lanes. So that doesn't back up at the ultimate ultimate volumes. And we identified a half a dozen or so turn pocket adjustments, lengthening, an additional right turn lane here or there throughout the corridor. And I won't go into the specifics of all those, but we identified a number of them. And then finally, traffic signal coordination. And I don't know if I could overemphasize this one. In 2040, and as we approach higher build volumes, it is absolutely imperative that we time the signals to maintain progression. If we have volumes that are on the very high end and you got to stop at every light, it's going to feel miserable and it will look as if though it doesn't have capacity, and we need to make sure that it does. And the way to make it work is to make sure that you have progression. So I would, you know, encourage the city to implement a really good coordination plan.
I'll finish it up here. I basically repeated Lauren's recommendations, and I just wanted to go through how we are actively implementing all of these recommendations as we speak or have already done so. You know, you hit on the speed limits, and I think we've mentioned it here before. That's the speed limits we're going with. It's consistent with, you know, changing that character of the road, but still getting traffic through, you know, at a decent speed. Roundabout at Stewart, you all have seen the design evolution of the roundabout. There's been three or four iterations. We are at two northbound, southbound, and two lanes westbound to southbound per the recommendations of this study. So we're all set there. Traffic signal at Appian Way, we're not putting in with this project, but there's nothing that's going to limit us with the design of this project to have that signal in the future if needed or when needed. New turn pockets, several locations. I've read them off to you before, but we're looking at, you know, some decel lanes at three or four places, and so also some lengthening, some left turn pockets. I've mentioned them before, but those will be in the 90% design. We are providing for U-turns for cars and pickups. So again, during that peak hour in that 2040 scenario where it's difficult to make a left-hand turn, that will be an option. And then the traffic signal coordination, you know, we hear Lauren loud and clear on that, and we'll have this effective signal timing plan, a coordination plan in place by the time the project, you know, construction is open and ready to be used with the new configuration. So, you know, I didn't prepare a summary slide, but I think hopefully that gives you a better understanding that, you know, we're allowed to do this project because we have seen essentially half the vehicles that were on that roadway are now gone from that roadway. It allows us to do these improvements. The intent, this project, the design, it's all based off, you know, the initial of wanting to change the character of that corridor. And I believe we are achieving those while meeting, you know, implementing some of this design optimization to ensure that it functions as effectively as we can make it function, not only now, but in the 2040 scenario. So hopefully that was educational and informational for you all and the public. And with that, I'll open it to any questions.
Questions? Well, we just start down here with Greg and go this way.
Do you have a graphic handy that shows the new roundabout? I'm curious how the westbound to southbound is going to look. I can see some safety issues with that, depending on how the lanes are configured.
I don't have one with me. I don't have, I do have my laptop, so I could technically get it. It may be if I have it on there, but we will, we're going to post an update on the website here, so it will be available there.
Is it in
the packet? Oh, it's in the packet. I think that's the old, because that's the old design.
Oh, is that the old one?
Because it doesn't have.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, so that is an older design because it still shows the bypass lane on the west side, and then it doesn't show the dual turn. So I don't have anything available to show you right now, but I'd be happy to provide it.
And the other thing I would, just a question, it just seems like some of these turn pockets are really long. And I'm sure your analysis, bears that out.
I'd simply respond that let's think 20 years out while we're designing this job so we're not coming up short and coming back to fix it later. So,
sure.
Yeah.
That's it.
So, first of all, I want to thank you very much for coming because I think that it's important that the public really could see the planning that went in to meet the 2040. I think that everyone kind of got hung up on the initial slide that you had in yellow that said, oh, we're doing a beautification project and that we're not really planning for the traffic needs. And so I think it's very important when you consider complete street, it wasn't that we're trying to favor a bicyclist or a pedestrian. We can't forget the motorist. And I think that kind of got lost maybe in all of the documentation and things we were doing. And you have to recognize that what the primary purpose of the road at this point is for the vehicle to move the traffic. So I really appreciate you taking the time to be realistic also with the public to say it's not that this is a perfect world. And here's where the design flaw comes when you try to solve for X, I get Y over here. And so my largest concern sits in the traffic signal arena because what I've noticed, if you look at College Parkway, it's the pedestrian hitting the walk button and causing a change and what you said. I can go College Parkway and stop at every single light. And I get a lot of complaints about that. Well, that's not going to be solved if you got bicyclists and pedestrians coming in, they're interrupting the pattern that you had for the system, right? Am I right in my thought process is that it changes what the timing is because I hit a button that said I wanted to cross the street?
So I would suggest that the coordination and optimization plan not allow the pedestrian to trump the coordination pattern. That is possible. It may be that your signals are currently set where they can break the pattern. That is done fairly commonly, particularly in low pedestrian areas. But it can certainly be done the other way too.
Thank you. I really appreciate that because that tends to be the complaint that, for me serving on RTC, that I get about the College Parkway, and I don't know whether it's because we allow the pedestrian to change the cycle or not, but I certainly think we should look at it because for the design to be successful, all the parts have to work, right? And just what you said, we've all got to be doing our role in the process. And I also appreciate that the extra product that we got out of this is that it was originally a complete street project. We're able to capitalize and do some utility work at the same time, but the utility work was not the primary purpose of the project. So thank you very much for doing this work, and I hope that it really helps the public to see the whole planning process and that no one is doing this in a vacuum, because that's I don't think we ever toot our own horn to say, no, we did take X and here's what we did to solve for it. So I know it was a lot more work, but I think it's a worthwhile thing, and it certainly helped me understand the project more. So thank you.
I appreciate the comments, and I just want to note too, I mean, I've heard it from, Supervisor Giomi made another point about, you can never you know, hit on the traffic, you know, the work that's being done that the public doesn't know about. You can't hit on that enough in the public setting. So, you know, I'll definitely try to do a better job when we come back for 90, maybe reiterating some of these points as well in the presentations that we do.
A few questions and comments, actually. First time I ever heard our president being used to trump the light, so I thought that was pretty good. I'm sorry, I had to bring it up, lighten up a little bit. Trump the light. So if you trump the lights for pedestrians, you got to make sure there's enough time to get the ADA across the street, or you got to give them a safe haven halfway. So if we're trumping the lights, we want to make sure that pedestrian crossing is safe or puts them in a safe place if they get in trouble halfway across. So I just wanted to make that point, which you probably have already. This is what you do for a living, actually. Before we trump the lights, that we're making sure all those things happen. So, for all these huge pockets, is the bike lane on the shoulder, or is it out between the traffic and the pocket?
Tom Grundy with Carson City Public Works. South of the roundabout, where the pedestrian path, the bike path, is separated from the road, the left turn or the right turn pockets are adjacent to the roadway. North of the roundabout, where there's a right turn pocket, the bike path will move over between the right turn lane and the straight lane.
See, when you have these large pockets, it really puts people out with your kids with a tote behind you out in, near the traffic versus over near the curb. So those longer pockets were a concern as a bicyclist if you're going to invite the public out rather than road bike people like myself that aren't as concerned.
And that's a good point. Especially one of the recommendations was to lengthen the right turn pocket at Fifth Street and to extend that right turn pocket after the full recommendation would take it back to 7th Street. And so that's an awful long way to make the bicyclists move over and be, you know, kind of more in the middle of the road. And so what we did there was we pulled back the improvements that we were going to do on the 6th to 7th Street block. So in the future, when the traffic warrants the extension of that right turn lane, it's just a paint change. But until we do that, the bike lane will stay next to the curb.
Yeah, that's a safe, but if you do have to put them in traffic, a well-striped, now I've seen the green come down sometimes now. Mm-hmm. The green method to really make it aware of them. And then the public, having ridden bikes for a long time, have a tough time making that right turn adjustment when there's a bike there. They don't feel as comfortable about just whipping over, and they don't like you out in the traffic side sometimes. They get a little concerned. So just a point, but it looks like you're working on that situation. If we're going to extend those pockets, that if you can get it over the curb, that'd be wonderful, actually. But Appian is a terrible street for the type of level of service it seems like is coming there. Did you look at trying to get them to Clearview to get on a light versus trying to put a whole new light at Appian, which is just down the street from Clearview? Can that all be done and make it only a right turn on Ape so you're not holding some bummer light, which is just a bummer?
Yeah, we did look at that in great detail, and I know the city has some other projects, and that's been discussed many times in the past. But our analysis showed that really with build-out of all those 7 projects I mentioned in that area, we do recommend a signal at Appian. And the reason is that Clearview, the westbound movements, would back up over to Cochise in the ultimate time frame. Be hard to process, and with the high intensity of some of the developments there on Appian, really a signal will be warranted and is appropriate. It also enables the realignment potentially of Snyder if that is in the city's best wishes, and it'll enable that. And in the big picture, it can make a lot of sense.
So when this project's done, are you going to be able to turn left off of Appian onto the road?
You'd still be able to turn north from South Carson Street onto Appian, the right. Northbound left. You would not be able to turn left out from Appian until a signal improvement.
Okay. I was hoping that they weren't going to open that up to try to make that crossing.
Certainly not.
Between there and Snyder, that's not the best intersection. Okay. All right, well, I clarified that. I'm, I thought maybe there was something I didn't know about for Road Street, that that one building would require much more work at that intersection. That this, has the city got big plans for Road Street, the National Guard building that was there all those years, that they're talking about future improvements there on roads? I had the first time I'd heard that there was any concern on Road Street. It's a pretty quiet intersection in there, I thought.
Right. The crux there is if the property on the east side, the Armory site, were ever to develop in a significant way, that would likely become an appropriate location for a signal.
So it is all commercial in there. If we, well, it's nothing. No, it's just state. No,
right.
Yeah.
Big if.
So you're just looking at every opportunity that could change in the future. So I shouldn't have to make comments to that. So I already told Lucia when I came to Mina how excited I was to see this plan. I mean, it really brings it into the world of transportation and how all these decisions are made versus just a group of people sitting in a room saying, well, let's do this and let's do this. So every aspect of transportation was covered in this plan. So a good plan, and I don't know who was the one that came up with the money and the decision, but accolades to that person, if it was Dan or Lucia or Darren. Thank you.
We have a good team, and Lauren did a good job, and Dan was really patient with us looking at all this in detail. So it was a good teamwork.
Thank you.
Indeed, I'd echo that. It seems like a very thorough report. I was under the impression that that stretch of South Carson Street was already coordinated for signals. Is that not the case?
Mm-hmm.
That portion of South Carson Street is coordinated. It's one of our, I believe, six coordinated corridors. That said, I think, you know, I don't want to speak for Lauren, so correct me if I'm wrong. Really, signal timing and coordination is an iterative process where as travel patterns change and evolve over time, they need to be revisited consistently. And so the city will need to invest and monitor and make sure that as that evolution happens, as those developments come in on the southeast side of Carson Street, that, you know, we're monitoring it and we're improving it and making sure that those platoons of vehicles coming northbound, coming southbound can get through and move through the corridor appropriately so they don't back up and queue in a way that really does create gridlock.
Yeah, and as that traffic pattern changes from the side streets in particular, the phasing order can have a big influence about how that works, too. So.
One additional comment on the signal timing related to some of the previous comments. We are in sort of a transition related to volumes. There's a lot of time of the day, probably 23 and a quarter hours of the day, where it's not necessarily needed to have a timing plan, where if there's a timing plan but there's no one there, you don't want to be waiting at the red for the phases to go through. So most of the day we do run our signals in what's called free. When it's running free, when a car hits there and there's no other cars, it's going to change the phase. So that operates the same if a pedestrian pushes a button. So that may be why some of your constituents see that or report that, where they're driving but the pedestrian gets there maybe an inch before, and so it'll trigger that phase. Now as we get more and more cars warranting those planned signal plans, that's when you implement those, and we can implement some of those strategies that Lauren mentioned.
If I may just add on, Commissioner McCrory, the opportunity here lies in that with narrowing the street, we have shorter pedestrian crossings, and so we can eke out some benefits there, and then with the change in lane configuration, we need to balance that. So that's the reason for the optimization.
Okay. Since I'm not a traffic engineer, is it possible to coordinate signals in both directions on a major corridor? Because my observation has been that maybe you take William Street, the lights are coordinated in one direction, and go in the other direction, you hit every single light red.
You driving against the flows.
I'm that salmon.
I can answer that for you. The answer is yes. But at that point, you're balancing several things going on. So if you know that if you have such a high directional split that 80% of your traffic is with the salmon flow, you want to coordinate to that because you're going to be throwing that off by trying to balance both north and south in this case. But you certainly can find the sweet spot for north and south, both being coordinated, it may not optimize the heavier of the two, and so there's that balance point, but all of those options are available.
And I assume that, through the process. That, as was mentioned earlier, that pedestrian crossing buttons and then also the signalized turn arrows can change the patterns if it's allowed. So I assume that when you get to the point where you need to coordinate the timing in both directions, then you can't allow those deviations, that it's a strict timing coordination regardless of what the actual traffic is. It's just a program that's implemented.
I'm really going to go traffic engineer on you now. you lit me up here. So the short story is what you have to do is put a maximum on the cycle length, and then you allocate the amount of green that you're going to give to north and south, and you maximize that, but you have to provide minimums on everything else so that everything is accommodated. Within that total cycle length, things can be adjusted. They can be traffic reactive. If the pedestrian never pushes the button, it never comes up. If a left turn vehicle never shows up, it never comes up. And you allow all that remaining green time to go to your major movement. So there are criteria, but there is flexibility, and that's part of that optimization process, is identifying who's going to get the time, when they come up, what patterns we're going to run. That's based on time of day. That's based on a number of factors, but that's all part of the optimization process.
So in page 9 of 16 of the evaluation, there's a table, cumulative conditions, level of service analysis results, which I believe that table shows some adjustments you made because the plan was done based on the 30% design, but then you got additional information about the 60% design, and then you recalculated the level of service based on those changes?
This table is based on the 30% design, and then we followed that with recommendations which would be incorporated. For example, the roundabout was shown at F, but with two lanes, it's not. It's acceptable. It goes back to D or better.
And then we already went over the turn pockets and the ability to make U-turns. Then you have two other tables in the appendix. One is on page 241. And the other is on page 271. So 241 is the existing levels of service for the 14 intersections or driveways that you analyzed. And I know that you spoke about this, but I was surprised at the number of E's and F's in our current traffic patterns. And then when you look at page 271, the 2040 cumulative conditions levels of service, there's a lot of F's on that page. So I know you spoke about that the F relates to amount of time stuck at that intersection or driveway. In 2040, in your professional opinion, are this many F's because they're on side streets and the amount of traffic is not significant enough that these are acceptable?
So again, this goes back to the decision of what we're trying to create. If the goal is to have a holistic multimodal roadway and we're balancing the needs of all users, yes, this is appropriate. Because what we're talking about is the side street movements, low volume. They would not warrant signals. We would not put a roundabout at every one of these locations. We would not be able to address every driveway in the corridor. And so under that framework, this is what has to be accepted. If that's the criteria and the goal of the project, then this is the outcome of it, in short. And I think you have to ask yourself, is 30 seconds of delay, and well, let's go to F, something 60 seconds of delay. Is that really unacceptable 20 years from now at build-out conditions considering the goals? Are they delayed? Absolutely. And that's why I said, let's be crystal clear. Some of those movements will be bad enough, people will move. They will take a different route. They will go and make a U-turn. That's the reality of what we're talking about. Is it unacceptable or not? I think, honestly, that's your decision. But I would say, in the context of what we're doing and giving the low volumes and the opportunities to move somewhere else, we have parallel routes. We have Curry Street. We have Stewart Street. I would tell you, if there were no parallel routes, I would get uncomfortable. I've done these projects in similar situations where there were not. And I when we had a very frank discussion at the city office, I said I would be very careful if we didn't have parallel routes because I would become uncomfortable. In this case, there are other options. There are ways to move around. Will there be delay? Yes. Is it acceptable in the big picture? I think yes.
So you preempted my next question, which was going to be, did you take into account in this analysis rerouting? And it sounds like you have.
The analysis as presented here assumes no rerouting. I wanted to remain conservative. Will rerouting occur? Yes. That will reduce.
Right, but based on your comments, you're comfortable with the levels of service based on your prediction that people will reroute. So, for instance, and this is one of the problems, once you get to F, so you were saying that F is 55 seconds or longer, there's no descriptors for above 55 seconds, and we have 3 or 5 locations on here that exceed 5 minutes for wait time.
If you are attempting to make a left turn, yes.
Right.
So that's why I say people will
right, choose so we to can't have routes. An F1, F2, F3, right? So there's no way for us to tell. But
no,
and once you get to F, you know, what's the difference between 55 seconds and 5 minutes? It's a huge difference.
It's true. And that's why I say, you know, very clearly people will reroute. There will be left turn movements that you will not attempt. And you will need to go right and make a left later or a U-turn or choose a different route to leave. That's reality.
But you're comfortable that this is a good plan and that in 2040 we're going to be able to accommodate our traffic patterns and volume of traffic based on this plan. Because I can tell you that the number one complaint that I get about the South Carson Street project is, why are you taking out the 2 lanes? Because we're going to need those in 20 years. And I can show them the statistics. The feedback I get, you know, I mean, I don't necessarily think it makes a difference in their mind.
Yeah.
So then you have to go to the experts to say, are you comfortable that in 2040 we're going to handle the volumes, we're going to handle the traffic, and that this plan is actually going to work?
Yeah. This is a management decision ultimately of the street. Is what do you want the street to be? It will feel different. 20 years from now, there will be more delay. You will choose to make more right turns than you do today. Those are all consequences of saying we want this street to be different. So in that context, is it appropriate? Yes.
Great. Thank you. Any additional questions or comments?
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll go to Lori first, then Mark, and then Chaz.
So maybe I just need a looking at page 271. So maybe again for the public that I'm clearly understanding what you're telling me in 2040. So the I'm just going to say I'm a little bit uncomfortable with designing that traffic will make U-turns. I'm not a big U-turn fan, especially what you're trying to tell me is at peak, I'm sitting at F, and then I'm going to have frustrated drivers who will find an alternative, of which one will be travel up a little bit further and flip a U-ey to be able to get your turn. I'm not a big fan of that. I'm just going to be really clear. I'm not a big fan of forcing people into U-turns. I don't think that's necessarily a good idea. But when I'm reading the chart, just so that it's clear, so if I were to go like to number 5 on here, it's an F. It's saying on the eastbound, the vehicles will be waiting greater than 300 seconds. How many vehicles, though? I mean, how? So it's not just that the vehicle that's right at the intersection to make the turn is waiting 300 seconds. How many are backed up? So is it really, pretend I'm car 10
sure.
in the line, right? Does that mean I'm waiting?
You're taking a nap.
Right? Is that, so I think I'm tracking with what Brad's trying to say. Are we making the right decision here? That we're not over how many cars are sitting there
yeah.
for the 300 so, seconds, and then the next guy's waiting, and sure. the next guy's waiting, and the next guy's.
So let's address number, not to jump in on you, sorry about that.
No, fine.
Let's address, that's the Colorado intersection. Let's
yeah.
address, that's number 5. In figure 14 of the report shows the 2040 cumulative traffic volumes. We're talking about 18 left turns in the morning and 13 in the afternoon. That's a very low number in the big picture when we're talking about 12 to 1300 on main line in each direction, 1700 southbound, right? So we're talking about a minuscule number. And again, if you said, well, I don't like that condition, I'm going to tell you that a condition essentially exists today, not to the same level, but to 35 or 40 seconds of delay. What would you do about it? Well, we would consider a signal. Well, I can tell you at 13 vehicles, we would never consider a signal. So, yes, we're talking about a change. Yes, we're talking about increasing delay. But we wouldn't likely solve it in any appreciable different way anyway. Right? We're not going to signalize that intersection at those types of volumes. So it's going to go to D, E, F over time. And we're going to say, yeah, that's how we manage the city. I'm sorry there's delay on that movement. Find another route. Make a right turn. I appreciate your comment about U-turns. But in the reality of managing a corridor 20 years from now, there will be U-turns. It's simply how we manage these types of – remember, this is one of the most major arterials in Carson City.
How many cars did you say? Because I can't see it on this.
Oh, sorry. It's estimated at 18 left turns in the morning and 13 in the afternoon.
Supervisor, that's packet page 226.
Page 226. Thank you.
And those, you know, many of the side streets that we're talking about are in that same level, less than 100 vehicles, many less than 20.
So maybe just which one's the worst? So which intersections, if we were to look at all of this, so what's the worst case scenario that you're projecting in the model? Because maybe that would help the public too to say, okay, the worst stack up of cars that we would get being delayed, that's going to is 258.
You picked it pretty well there. I think you got it, actually.
I tried. Like, am I reading this right?
Colorado's less than 20. Sonoma's less than 15. Moses is less than 20. And the rest that we studied are signalized. So I mean, you picked on the worst one.
Okay, good. That helps. Again, I just want the public to understand it's – we're not ignoring the situation. We recognize the situation, but this is how you solve for it, or you don't. Right? It's fair and honest to say.
That's right.
You're right. It's only 18 or 13 vehicles, and it's not all at the same moment in time. I'm going to guess it's close to the same moment in time.
Spread over an hour.
They're going to, right. They're going to work, or they're coming. Right.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. That helps.
My first question is NDOT. I was at a meeting and they were actually excited because they now have the blinking yellow left turn so you don't get stuck at the intersection. Wouldn't that have an impact on the ability to turn left if you have the blinking yellow so people can cross at any time versus waiting for the green line?
We're talking about, in this particular case, unsignalized intersections. And so,
all those where they're stacking is the stop sign ones.
These are the side street stop conditions.
Well, the blinking yellow also helps at the signalized ones too.
True.
That's maybe where they go to the signalized one and then come back, rather than a U-turn. Let's see where you caught me on that.
That's the alternate route. Go find a signal.
Right, and throughout the quarter, signals are generally not very far away.
No,
I mean,
so they can get there.
We're talking about a block or two in most cases.
See, I always thought the Fandango was a setup to stop you in front of the casino so you could see that sign. Because I'm always stopped at the Fandango. It's light for some reason off the subject. So I'm asking this question. I don't see any reason or difference between a four-lane or a six-lane when it comes to these turns. I don't see any difference in what you're projecting in your traffic flows, whether you have six lanes or four lanes.
I'm glad you bring up that point because what we're really talking about as the most significant change in this is the change in traffic volume over 20 years. Yes, traffic will be condensed from two lanes to three, and that creates fewer gaps in those two lanes. But it's also difficult to cross a six-lane roadway, right? Let's be honest. It's extremely uncomfortable in many cases to try to pick gaps across three oncoming lanes. And so there's some balance there. But the major change here is the growth in traffic volume, not the change in the roadway configuration.
And a reminder that the F, the way you're talking about it, the way I read this, it's only during those peak times.
We're talking about the peak hours of
the day. Which are just this little tiny piece of a 24-hour day that the F level is happening for the users of this section. And 2040, I won't be here to witness any of that. But
But you're making good decisions.
That's a big deal for those people in the future.
Thank you.
Mark actually stole my question, but between the four lane and six lane configuration, do you have any estimate of how the gaps differ? In other words, is there a percentage that it would be instead of waiting over 300 seconds, you would be waiting 280 seconds? Sort of. I mean, is there any? Do you have that sort of data?
No, we didn't go to that level of analysis. Certainly, if you want to just use round numbers, you're probably losing 25% of gaps, right? Because you've condensed 3 to 2. So it's not probably 30%, but it's because those gaps exist between platoons of traffic, which, by the way, these traffic signals are going to create gaps in those platoons, especially when well-coordinated. We're going to have a platoon come through, stops with these signalized locations every 2 to 3 to 4 blocks. Those are creating gaps for those left turn movements. Those are addressed to some degree in this analysis, but that's something that's very hard to simulate accurately. So just understand that the gaps will be created. This analysis doesn't fully recognize this. We've not sugarcoated this in any way, shape, or form, as you can see. We've provided the worst case analysis that we can, and just presented it at face value. But there's going to be factors that still allow people to make movements. In particular, off-peak, it's going to be really nothing like this. That we're talking about worst peak conditions.
All right. Thank you very much. That was very informative, and thank you for bearing with all of our questions. I would ask for public comment, but we don't have any public left. So I guess we're not going to have any.
Are you posting this on the Carson Proud instead of just the normal place where we do agenda items so that I can point people there?
Is that a request,
yes,
Supervisor?
Yes, I just think it's a nice place to be able to just point everybody to that page and say, hey, we really did look at this, and here's the scenarios if they're interested in that depth. But nice job again.
Absolutely, yes.
Yes, it's a great report.
It really is.
Okay, this was informational only. Did you have a comment?
I see your point, but I also see the other side where if you get people that are reading this and they're not educated very much, it's going to really, because seriously on these intersection analyses where you have the Fs, and that I just see a whole slew of new questions coming up from the general public. I don't. It's just my opinion.
I appreciate you watching out for us, Greg. But I can tell you, we're getting the emails and phone calls anyway. So it's an educational opportunity. Like, the more people that read it and don't understand it and contact us, it gives us an opportunity to kind of walk through it with them and explain it to them. And I'd rather do that now than after the road's built.
Sure.
So. Thank you for your comments.
I think it would be a good idea to pair this report with the PowerPoint that kind of walks through the purpose and need of the project as well.
Yeah, and also with this public meeting that we're having today, I think, too, with the link to that, so they can see the discussion we've had, they can see the report, they can see the PowerPoint. I think all of that together will help them get the full picture of what's going on.
Will they at least have the opportunity to educate themselves? And I'm always gonna go to that fault. I'd rather answer more questions to say, hey, the information's out there if you wanna. We're not hiding anything. It's there.
How about getting Lauren's cell phone number?
I like that too.
Disconnected. All right. If there's no more questions or comments, then we will thank you again for the presentation, and we will move on to agenda item 6E. Informational presentation and discussion on Carson City's Virginia and Truckee Railroad sales tax plan of expenditure as it relates to upcoming roadway improvement projects. Lucia, or am I going to be surprised again here?
Just me.
Okay.
Thank you, Supervisor. Lucia Maloney, Transportation Manager. This is an item that went to the Board of Supervisors last November. It's, in my opinion, overdue for an update to RTC, so you all are aware if you are not already. The Board of Supervisors adopted the amended plan of expenditure for the VNT Railroad sales tax. And this is to expend the unexpected excess revenues derived from that sales tax debt. And it was approved in November of 2018. The amended plan of expenditure is included in the staff report. Starting on packet page number 313, the amendment included two projects. Project B of the plan of expenditure included the Roop Street Rehabilitation Project. It's a 0.2-mile reconstruction of Roop Street from East 5th north to East Musser. The routes are critical, north-south access connection. The asphalt is in very poor condition. There's sidewalk issues, and the ramps do not meet ADA standards. Design for that project is planned to start this fall with construction planned for next spring. Project B also included the Clearview Drive Preservation Project. This is 1.2 miles from Carson Street all the way over to the freeway. This project is really having to do with critical timing of the life cycle of the asphalt there. It's important to get a microsurface coat on that asphalt to keep it in good condition. So that's what this project is. There's very few, if any, ramps on that section, and none that are going to be included in this project. Project B, the Clearview project, was estimated at the time of the plan expenditure to be $173,000. Clearview was sent out for quotes in April. They came back at $84,007. That has been contracted, and additional details on that project are contained on packet page number 346. Construction for that is scheduled to start sometime in July. The savings, if you will, on that Clearview project from the estimate to the actual will just simply carry forward into Project C of that plan of expenditure. So Project C of the plan of expenditure is essentially a pay-as-you-go for capital improvement projects on the city's regional roads. Projects will be planned and implemented in accordance with the city's pavement management plan that RTC approved. So we're looking now at Performance District 2 for fiscal year 20. That's in the southeast portion of Carson City, downtown portion. In any case, District 2, and so this BNT money will essentially go into the pot for the city's projects for District 2 for next year, and then onward until the plan of expenditure expires in July of 2027.
So can I object to that, since I represent Performance District number 1, which was done last year, and now isn't going to get any money?
That is an excellent question, Supervisor. So we as staff had planned to use this year's money on the Gonai reconstruction project. It's been in the project status report of the RTC packet as a funding source for that Gonai reconstruction. Because Gonai did come in under budget, we chose to not use those VNT funds and carry those forward. But District 1 will not be excluded from those projects. Public Works Director has been very clear on that. So we will keep you in mind as we look at projects moving forward. Just to conclude the summary points, it's estimated that approximately $350,000 will be available for the Project C each year. I did get an update from the CFO this morning. The carry forward for fiscal year 19, we're closer to $600,000, so it was higher than expected. This, of course, is, you know, semi-unpredictable depending on sales tax revenues coming in, but we'll continue to monitor those. And for everyone's, for the record, again, this money is after the funds are reserved for debt service on these bonds. So happy to answer any additional questions, but I just thought it was valuable to provide an update to this group on this additional funding pool for roads.
Questions from the commissioners? Mark?
Just a short one. You probably have an answer. That since this money is available, is there any programs out there where you could double it or use it as a match to enhance that little bit of money that we have to grow that? And you're going to be able to have an answer for that.
Commissioner, that's a great comment. I'm glad you brought it up. So this counts as valuable local match dollars. There is a condition on the VNT funding that it must be used on capital projects. So the way the city categorizes, we would never use this money on like a slurry seal, but a micro seal or a, you know, mill and overlay or full reconstruction are considered capital projects. So potentially this could be used as match for like a STBG grant funding for a bigger project for Carson City.
Any other comments or questions?
Just a reminder that this tax will, it has a sunset, an ending provision, so it's a good fix for a few years, a small amount of money, which seems big, but not in the road world. But it does end in, I think, 27.
So, in the road world?
In the road world, yeah. When you say it's $1 million a mile or something like that, it's like, oh, my gosh. Yeah.
$1 million a mile if there's no
ADA.
Yeah. All right, last call for questions, comments. Otherwise, we're moving on. Any public comment on this? And again, we have no public. So moving on, we are now on agenda item 6F for possible action, discussion of possible action regarding an interlocal agreement between Carson City and Douglas County, through which Carson City staff will provide technical support and maintenance of traffic signals and lighting in Douglas County and authorizing the transportation manager to execute the document. Lucia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had hoped Mr. Erb would stay from the Campo meeting, but I think he trusted me not to flummox this. So Douglas County's Board of Supervisors approved this agreement last Thursday, the 6th. Douglas County has requested technical services for signal operations and maintenance. We've done a similar agreement with them in 2011 and then again in 2014. This agreement this time is slightly different from the previous ones we've had with Douglas County. I noted the details in the staff report. The key primary difference is really the way in which the city can recuperate the costs to operate and maintain these signals. It's much more clean and very straightforward. We now reimburse at our true rates up to a dollar amount, $100,000 per any individual fiscal year. It's very straightforward. This is this agreement was built off the template, if you will, that we used with the Story County agreement last year. We'd like as staff to use this template moving forward if we do renew the other ones in the future. Happy to answer any questions. This is pretty straightforward.
Questions, comments? It was nice to use the template since we already reviewed it. We're familiar with it. It made it much easier to read and get through. So anytime we can find those efficiencies, it's very helpful. So public comment, no public comment. And so I will bring this back to the commission and entertain a motion.
I move to authorize the transportation manager to execute the interlocal agreement as presented.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. Passes unanimously. And we are now on agenda item 7, internal communications and administrative matters, non-action items. We will start with 7A, transportation manager's report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did want to provide an update on the city's East-West Connector project. This is a utility project primarily along Washington Avenue. We don't present on it in here because it's a utility project, but I did want to give the update that staff are taking the award of the construction contract to the Board of Supervisors next week. Approximately $1 million is being invested on the road reconstruction of Washington Street alone, which includes sidewalk improvements, ADA improvements, crosswalk improvements, particularly at Sunset, where we've gotten a lot of public comment in the past. So this is a really good another example where we're doing a dig wunch approach for roads and utilities at the same time. So that'll be moving forward. Construction will start this summer. So that's really exciting. And then I already previously alluded to it at the Campo meeting. Two new buses went out this week. We're finalizing how we read the data from that comes from the cameras on the buses. So hopefully they'll go into service tomorrow. These are two 35-foot fixed route buses. They were awarded with the 5339B FTA grant funds that were announced at the same time as the Tiger grant. So it takes a period of time to order these buses and get them in, about 10 months. So long overdue, and we're really excited for those. That concludes my report.
Any questions on the report? No? All right. Moving on to 7B, Street Operations Activity Report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Street operations activities on item 7B are for April of 2019. Just start at the top and hit the highlights for you. We did do 209 blocks of sealant for crack seals. These were primarily in the Oak Ridge Drive part of town. Down in tree care chemical treatment, you'll see a note about the elm trees and the elm beetle that we talked about last month. At that time, I reported that we had completed all of the trees. That statement is still true. The way that the month was broken out, this was done at the same time, but it was, you know, a day or two later. And so I didn't lie to you. It just comes in a different reporting period. So I wanted to make that clarification for you. Down in grading and shoulder maintenance, that dirt work, we did install a new catch basin and storm drain pipe across East Nye at Viking. There was a lot of flooding that happened. The water was going over the curb and gutter and the sidewalk into the property owner's property. It was a big problem area, so we're hoping that this fixes that issue. And then on the back page, you'll see signs and markings. April is really the start of when we go out there and we do those signs and markings, particularly the pavement markings. Sometimes we start in March, but this year we start a little bit late because of the storms. I'll also take this opportunity to let you know that we awarded that long line striping contract last month or the month before. Those are scheduled to happen in July in the next couple weeks here. So you'll start to see those happening out there. Happy to answer any other questions on this report.
Questions on the activity report?
Did we do pizza this month? No.
Right. No. No pizza for potholes.
No. All last right. month, April.
Didn't we do so we're now on agenda item 7C, project status report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Goring's over there, so he'll give me the eye if I miscommunicate anything. We'll start at the South Carson Street Complete Streets project, which you got an update on today. Last I heard, we will anticipate a 90% update in August here at RTC. The Freeway Multi-Use Path project to Colorado, we are making progress toward 90% design. As previously noted at last RTC meeting, this project was deprioritized a little bit just due to funding limitations on some of our other grants and staff resources. We just had to make some trade-offs. But this is still in the plan and moving forward. Fairview Drive reconstruction project, all the target for these grant funds that are expiring are to get to the full design to NDOT by July 15th. So we've really been pushing hard on this one. We made good progress and have submitted the 60% plans to NDOT to trigger their review of that plan. Kings Canyon Trailhead Improvement Project. Dirk was out there with the Central Federal Lands and the project team, which included open space staff earlier this week and other public works staff. Design is moving along. The update I received was that we expect to get 75% plans around August, and so that's moving along. It's been, you know, I always comment on this project, the partnership between public works and open space, but it's been working really well. Open Space has provided some really good comments related to operation of their trailhead, those monument signs and directional guidance signs that they have up there, potentially moving them down closer to the parking lot for accessibility, and some different things that we don't always think about as transportation, so that's been really positive. Dirk, Rob Fellows, and some other park staff have gone out and met with the property owners. They've provided really good feedback about the location of the restrooms, how people access the trail, how people cross the parking lot. It's been really insightful, and Dirk's done a good job of incorporating those comments and talking with Central Federal Lands on how to make this project appropriate for Carson City. So that's moving forward in a really positive way.
Can we go back to the Fairview Drive reconstruction sure. project? So you said that 60% plans were submitted to NDOT for review, and 90% plans were scheduled to be submitted by July 15th. So if they're reviewing the 60% plans and we're working on the 90% plans, is there a communication going on? Because otherwise we're making changes to the 90% without having the feedback, the review feedback on the 60%.
The schedule is really tight. I think the details on the city side for 60 to 90 really revolve around some of the utility work, some of the trenching and the waterline extension in front of the old barbecue place right there. Sort of west of Lowe's, we're moving forward on the 90%. That said, the timing is really tight, but any comments we receive from NDOT, there'll be time to incorporate. Dirk, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the comments we would expect would have to do with the patching section or the reconstruct section of the road. They're more concerned with the road. So we're able to move forward sort of parallel while still making sure we meet their deadlines.
So is there interim conversations going on? So you're getting feedback without getting formal feedback. You're getting informal feedback so you know what to look at?
Dirk, off the record, yeah, we are communicating weekly, you know, as we need it. But also keep in mind with the design, you have, you know, 30, 60, or 90. Typically, you have kind of, all right, this is what's included in a 30, whether it's, you know, the preliminary concept, the general layout. Then as you move forward, you're like, all right, well, now we're going to start working on cross slopes or drainage or grates. And so all these are kind of more industry standards with what's included in this, in the different design packages. So as you progress from 60 to 90, you're almost kind of moving on to different elements of the design. And so that when you come back, the comments that we get from MnDOT are usually tweaks. And a lot of times, as you kind of alluded to, if there are comments, they'll let us know over the phone or over email very fairly quickly, and we can kind of work them into the design.
Great. Thank you. Sorry about the interruption.
That's great. Please do interrupt. The Stewart Street Pedestrian Signal Project, you've probably seen them out there. As I understand, the contractor finished maybe yesterday or the day before. MnDOT came in and they helped us out with some of the ramps at Little Lane. There's been some discussions, and it's been a good partnership with working through some of these, you know, real-time construction challenges. So hoping to wrap that up. I don't know, what do you say, Dirk? This week? Next week? Soon?
Wait for the road report. We'll see.
Excellent. The CDBG College Parkway Improvements Project, we talked about that earlier this evening. Same with the Edmonds Sports Complex multi-use path. The Airport Road Sewer Replacement Project, we are developing preliminary designs. This is on the same schedule as the Fairview project with those STBG funds that we have for this project. I did make the comment earlier this evening related to the driveways and the ADA, just so you're aware of that. That said, you know, Dirk is really good with working with the project managers and the engineers to ensure that we're getting the ramps where we need them, that we're meeting those ADA needs. So we are currently talking about how we can make sure we have those ramps and ADA improvements. I'll also note, if you've driven northbound on Airport and you try to turn onto Menlo, westbound on Menlo, there is a valley gutter there. That is a transit route. It's been highly problematic for the 35-footers. The back of the bus drags, and we're losing maybe 6 brackets a month on that valley gutter, on that turn. They have to be really slow, really careful. And so we're hoping to clean up that. You'll see that bump now that I've told you. If you drive out there, we're hoping to clean that up with this project as well.
That's one of those alternate routes that everyone has talked about.
Yes. So moving on to the District 1 pavement preservation projects, these are all moving forward. We awarded the contract in March, and construction's on schedule to begin in July. That said, the CDBG ramp portion of the College Parkway job, we want to get the concrete in first before the asphalt goes. So staff are really closely coordinating that with the contractors. The Gonay Road reconstruction we talked about earlier this evening. You will note the VNT fund was there and budgeted, but fortunately not needed, but we will make sure that we properly and fairly do projects in District 1. District 1 street lighting, we have been working closely with NV Energy. They have their process. It just takes time, but there's 2 locations identified for additional street lighting, as you know. And then finally, the District 1 pavement preservation part 2. This is the College Parkway portion, which I miscommunicated just a second ago, but this is the piece that we're coordinating with the CDBG project. The very last page I've already talked about this evening is the Clearview project with the VNT funds. So happy to answer any other questions or anything else project related you'd like to discuss.
Just to comment that the construction of that new motel, has really cleaned up Arrowhead and Carson Street there.
Fisher Stay.
Yeah, that's really nice, and the added enhancements to get people on and off. That was really beneficial, and the city probably didn't pay a dime for that, I would guess, but because it's never been on your list.
I do know that we just received reimbursement for some signal improvements, some inductive loops that we put in related to some of those changes, and so there was a fair share contribution from that project.
Any other comments or questions on the projects? Okay, 7D, future agenda items.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Staff have been working hard. If you can't tell between this month and the last couple months versus where we were maybe 6 months ago, we have a lot more agenda items. Our agendas are running pretty long. That's all thanks to our two new staff members. Mike and Dan have just really gotten up to speed really quickly and helped round up the team in a really good way. So thrilled to have them here. Next month with RTC, I will talk with Supervisor Bonkowski. Commissioner Kimbrough did request potentially an informational presentation on road funding, so it may or may not come next month or in a future month. It is on the list, though. Dirk will give an update on the pavement management plan implementation from the first year. We may see some plan amendments based on lessons learned, and hoping to get board direction on any changes or recommendations for District 2 next month. We may or may not also give an update on the JAC advertising revenue. I think it's been a long time since we've talked about that, and that's something we've been kicking around as staff to talk about where we are and where we think we need to go.
How are we doing with Safe Routes to School? Any comment there, or should I not have asked that?
Safe Routes to School does still exist. We have been doing Bike Month. Kudos to Muscle Powered. They really stepped up on behalf of Carson City and did some amazing Bike Month activities. As you know, Commissioner McQuarrie, there was a celebrity bike ride. There was Bike to School Day. There was all sorts of activities, and the community really came together despite us not having a bicycle and pedestrian coordinator. Hoping to give some additional program updates in the near future.
Any other questions? Jazz?
So, Lucia, just to piggyback on that, are we actively looking for a new Safe Routes to School person?
Yes, absolutely. We hope to fill that vacancy soon. You know, it's been brought to staff's attention that the position of bicycle and pedestrian coordinator and the Safe Routes to School program, as it was originally envisioned, was really a program that was born out of the health department and the health's CHIP program, really focused on healthy kids and getting outside. Now that the program's in Public Works doesn't really do that, though it is important. Public Works is great at infrastructure projects and building safe routes, sidewalks, ADA, all these good things we've talked about tonight. So the program's evolving a little bit, and the candidate we come in to fill that spot will have the qualifications more tailored to that direction within Public Works.
Like, you guys can do audits and stuff too, like they do, so you're out making sure we're doing the best we can to get the kids to have an opportunity to walk to school or bike to school too, right?
So that's absolutely correct. The candidate we bring in will be more of a transportation planner focused on active transportation and those infrastructure planning activities.
Any other comments on future agenda items? All right, then we're going to move on to agenda item 8, board comments for information only. We'll start over here with Chaz. Any reports?
Nope. I've talked too much today.
All right. I have a couple comments. First, we talked tonight about the V&T sales tax, that money now going towards roads, which will help. The legislature approved SB 48, the diesel tax, which should generate about an additional $400,000 per year for roads. We, as the Board of Supervisors in the past, have looked at every opportunity to provide surplus general fund monies to roads. I think I did a quick addition and came up where we're looking at about an additional $1 million a year in funding potentially if everything goes well. So that only leaves us a deficit of about $12 million a year that we got to figure out. So having said that, my last comment is that looking at our current staff additions, I think that Dirk probably needs to let his beard start growing.
We will take that as a directive.
Great. All right. So if there's no other board comments, then our next meeting is tentatively scheduled at 4:30 p.m. Well, it'll be scheduled after the Campo meeting That starts at 4:30 p.m. on Wednesday, July 10th, right here in the Sierra Room. And time for our final public comment, and we still have no public. So going once, going twice, and I will entertain a motion for adjournment.
So moved.
All right, thank you all for showing up and participating.